Hey, everybody. My name's Dane.
And I'm Jimmy.
And our podcast is called Bubbling Questions.
We do would-you-rathers from listeners and a Twitter bot.
Along with one-person game shows using ridiculous stuff we find on the internet.
Like, what kind of dick are we talking?
I shall not tell you.
Okay. All from our very real hot tub.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Very real. Not a gimmick at all. Find Bubbling Questions wherever you get podcasts.
And I'm Jimmy.
Welcome to Escapist Comics Podcast. I'm Jessica Balboni.
And I'm Jesse Hitt.
And today is Thursday.
What's the December 13th.
The 13th. Ooh, Thursday the 13th.
Yeah, very spooky.
Totally spooky.
Scariest day of the month.
And we have a very special guest today. It's an interview day on Escapist Comics Podcast. Yeah. We have Ron V. And hi. How are you doing today?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm doing all right. It's 10:30 at night here in the UK, so I'm pretty chilled out right now.
Yeah, we have a pretty big time jump, jumping in space.
Yeah, guess is coming from a land in turmoil. The UK almost lost the prime minister this week.
Oh, my God.
That's my understanding of it, at least, I guess.
Yeah, it's so close.
Yeah,
we have a Brexit over there. Not Brexit. I don't know what we're doing over there, right?
I don't know. Everywhere seems to be pretty crazy.
That's true, yeah.
Just about now.
Luckily, we don't have to talk about that. We can just talk about comics, which is a lot more fun.
Yeah.
In case you guys aren't familiar, though, you should be, because we push them a lot in our store. Ron V writes, especially right now, These Savage Shores, which we absolutely love.
Mm-hmm.
Also, Paradiso, which did really well. Rune of Thieves, which we really like, too. And then ones we're not so familiar with, which we'd love to talk about, Black Mamba, and did one too that came out just in India as well, which was
Graffiti's Wall came out recently in the UK, and it is slated for US release next year. So I did a comic back in India called Aghori, which was my first sort of comic before I was actually into making comics. And I've done, I did a Batman story this year in Batman Secret Files.
It had a flashy cover, very sparkly cover.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about like Black Mamba and Aghori, which, you know, when you first started writing comics?
So Aghori was my first foray into comics. I had never written a comic book script before that series. I was usually into writing prose. I had a few short stories and stuff published. And one of my friends came up to me and said, you have a really visual style, and I know you enjoy comics, so why don't you try writing some of them? And so I did. I wrote a couple of scripts. I wrote a couple of short stories that were published in anthologies. And that made me kind of think that, hey, you know what? I can probably do a 22-page thing. And I went over to the Indian Comic Book Convention, went to one of the publishers there, and told them I had an idea that I would like to pitch, blah, blah. And they heard my pitch and they said, all right, let's do it. So that's how I wrote Aghori, which is the easiest way to explain it is it's kind of an Indian John Constantine.
Sweet.
Cool. So it's kind of like a really dark Indian street magician. So Ghoris are these kind of sect of Hindu worshippers who believe that nothing is terrible in their pursuit of enlightenment. And so they do some pretty dark stuff. And are supposed to be sort of on the fringes of forbidden magic and stuff like that. So I took that kind of mythology and put it into an urban sprawl like Mumbai. And I did very Constantine-esque stories. And it became quite a hit. So we did, I think we did close to 18 issues of that book in India before I moved over to the UK.
Cool.
Yeah. Over 2 years too. So it was baptism.
Yeah, seriously, you really jumped in.
First ever comic book script. And then I was told by the publisher, yeah, you have to do 16 more things.
God.
Was there anything you found particularly difficult sort of transitioning from writing regular prose to writing comic strips, or anything alternatively that you found particularly like freeing about the comic form?
So with prose, obviously you have to focus on your usage of words, descriptions, and rhythm in your prose, if you will, to really build momentum and keep the reader going. Obviously, it's easier to do that with a comic book because you've got the artist doing a lot of the heavy lifting in terms of descriptions and atmosphere and tone. So it's easier on that side of things. But the hardest thing, and I always talk about this with any creator, the hardest thing to figure out in comics, and no one tells you how to do it, and you can't really learn it from anywhere. You just have to make enough bad comics until you finally understand how to make a good one. Is pacing. Pacing is really hard to understand in comics, and it really becomes like this instinctive thing that you know how much information works on a page, and you know which pages are going to go by faster when the reader's reading them versus which pages the reader's going to linger for a while.
It's almost kind of like writing like a movie script too, right? Like you're reading a movie. That's what I always found like a story. Like a storyboard.
I actually think it's easier to write a movie script than it is to write a comic. Within reasonable subjectivity there, but if you're good at doing both things, you really have to think about a comic more in terms of, okay, what do I show in each panel to convey the action and to convey passage of time between each panel? Whereas you don't have to worry about that stuff with writing a screenplay because you just show it. You know it's going to happen on screen. You know how much time it's going to take to show a particular action.
Right. Because you're kind of the director,
that kind of stuff,
too, right?
Yeah. Yeah, you have to describe to the artist, I would guess, what you want them to draw.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. And sometimes, you know, you can't just say, you know, he stubs out his cigar.
Yeah.
Because you could put that in a film script and it's easy to show that. But if you want to show someone sort of putting out his cigar, you have to show him smoking it in one panel. And then at some point, the next panel has to be down in an ashtray. So you're never actually showing him do the action. You're only showing the beginning and the end of it. So the before and the after, if you will. And that's kind of how comics works for every action, Marius. You never have to think about that stuff when you're writing a screenplay.
Right. Speaking of artists, I thought, especially with Paradiso and with these Savage Shores, the artist that works on the book does a particularly good job of sort of illustrating these settings. And in both stories, I think like the setting is almost kind of the star of the story. How do you put together your creative teams, or how did the teams come together?
These are really guys that I've worked with before. Dave did work on Black Mamba with me, which was my first self-published project. And he did two stories in that book. He's very good at that kind of gritty, noirish art. And we got around to talking about Paradiso, and I usually have a sense of what I want a project to look like in my head before we actually start working on it. So I knew Paradiso needed that kind of old school metal hurling, bande dessinée kind of French sci-fi vibe to it, and I knew Dave would be able to pull that off because I knew he was already working in the vicinity of that style. And same thing with Sumit. Sumit and I had worked on Rune of Thieves before. And again, I knew that he had this kind of style that's in between Disney caricaturized animation and that kind of, again, old school European, lots of panels on a page, very intricate kind of art. And so I knew that he would be a great fit for these Savatures as well.
Yeah, I mean, the art's absolutely beautiful in it. And yeah, like Jesse said too, the backgrounds really do like set the story like so well.
And even the lettering is cool. I guess it's Aditya Bidikar did the lettering in these Savage Shores. And it's cool because the story's partially told through letters back and forth. So you see each character's handwriting and sort of like how, you know, that character, like the Lord guy has very fancy cursive, and the lowborn monster hunter guy has sort of a basic uppercase letter script style. So it's really cool seeing the different kinds of lettering.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Aditya letters all of my books, and he is by far the most knowledgeable person I know in comics.
Yeah.
He knows a lot of stuff about a lot of things in comics. And so it's always interesting because he's already seen and done a lot of stuff. I like to challenge him in my scripts to do stuff that he hasn't done before. So what a lot of people might not know about these Savatures is a lot of these scripts that he's used for the letters. Mm-hmm. He's designed those fonts himself.
Cool.
I mean, they're variations of other things that exist, but yeah, he's created those fonts so you won't find them in any other book anywhere else, you know.
Well, that's really cool. Speaking of these Savage Shores, the history and the background feels like incredibly real to us. And so, what type of research did you do to go into the world building?
I've always been kind of a history buff, to be honest. So I didn't have to do a lot of research. A lot of it happens kind of organically when I'm thinking about the story. Mm-hmm. Like when I was growing up, I grew up with a fairly religious grandparents, and they'd always tell me these stories of Indian mythology. And so I'd heard versions of these stories when I was a kid. And so it was just a matter of looking up those things and doing a little bit more research into the mythology to find out the specifics of things, but the larger overall story of who these characters are has been in my head since I was a kid. There was a bit of historic research involved, but most of that stuff is available on the internet. Being from that area, obviously it's beneficial because I've actually seen the Mysore Palace, which you see in issue 2. And I know of the history of those places, so it becomes easier to sort of work in that sandbox and create your own story within it, if you will.
Yeah. So you said that you know some of the mythology. So was it actually based on like a certain myth in that you?
Yeah. Every time, like you'll notice every time Corey and Bishan are there in each of the issues, she asks him how he was made.
Right.
And he gives her a different explanation each time.
Yeah.
So all of those explanations are actually stories in Indian mythology. And the bizarre thing about a mythology that's so old and so it kind of organically grew is that there are contradicting stories about everything. You know, some say that, oh, this is how Rakshasas were made. And then someone else comes up and goes, no, that's not right. This is how they were made. So I like the idea that this character never quite explains who he actually is. And each time he says it, he gives you a different story of how he was made.
Yeah, I noticed that too. He does. He changes it every time.
Cool. And for the listener at home, if you haven't read these Savage Shores yet, one of the main characters is a sort of immortal, shape-shifting, almost werewolfish character.
Demon,
kills a vampire in a very badass way. Yeah. Was his physical appearance based on, like, again, was it based on a particular, like, mythological creature or demon or entity?
I mean, not really, because we had descriptions of what a Rakshas. Mm-hmm. So he's supposed to be a Rakshas, which is the Indian equivalent of the vampire mythology. They, you know, they come out at night, they live in forests, they mm-hmm. drink blood, and they're supposed to be these kind of gigantic evil creatures. But they're often depicted with horns, with tusk-like teeth. And so in that, we had an idea of what their description would be from, you know, carvings and cave paintings of these things.
Yeah.
But I also knew that, you know, we wanted to create something that had a unique look for this book that people would remember. So
right.
I think we mishmashed a lot of things there. So it looks like, it looks humanoid partly, but he also looks werewolfish kind of from the torso down. But then he's got these like giant ram's horns and a mane that goes down the back. So, so yeah, we wanted to create like a character with a unique look for this. And we took a lot of sort of textual descriptions of what Rakshasas look like from the research that we did, and we came up with that. So part of it's fictionalized, part of it's true, quote unquote true.
Yeah, but I really like that, you know, this is, it feels like a really untapped like source. Like there, you don't see a lot of like Indian background or history used in comics. Did you feel like this was like a new source that you were like bringing to like the American world, basically?
Yes, yeah, that's a very interesting story there. So my first kind of book that I did outside of India was Black Mamba. And Black Mamba is this thing that basically takes American crime noir but sets it in Mumbai. And with the twist that none of the stories in that book actually have any crime. So I did that book and I pitched it around to publishers. It was my first time, you know, nobody knew who I was or what work I'd done. And obviously I got turned down by a lot of publishers, a lot of them saying that the work is really good, but this is not the kind of book we'd publish. I mean, it was a black and white book as well and an anthology. So not a lot of publishers looking out for that kind of stuff. But I sent it to Top Shelf, which had just been taken over by IDW as an imprint. And I remember Chris Staros at Top Shelf was the publisher, looked at this and said, you know, this is really good work, but you're going to have a tough time selling it to publishers. You should just crowdfund this. I crowdfunded that book and it did really well. Later on, you know, seeing that success, I got asked to do another book, which was set in Mumbai, which is Graffiti's Wall, which came out this year. And now when I talk to publishers, you know, publishers come back to me and say, hey, can you do something, you know, more Indian, set around India? Because that seems to be doing really well. So it's a weird journey I've had, going from not being able to publish something that was set in India to now being asked to write stories that are all set in India. So I guess I didn't do it intentionally, but I am obsessed with the idea that places influence the kind of stories you tell. And you can see that in Paradiso as well, which is not set in India. But I like the idea that people can learn a little bit about a place that they've never been to, or people can feel a little closer to the culture of another place just by reading a book, rather than if you have not had the chance to actually go there.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, like I said, we haven't seen anything like this, and that's what we're looking for, because there's been so much science fiction and so much, you know, just of the same book that comes out over and over again. But this book was so different, and that's why we really liked it. And I'm guessing that's why Vault was like, hey, this is something different too.
Imagine my surprise, because, it's really different. But also imagine me going to someone going, hey, I'd like to pitch you a vampire story.
Every
publisher probably gets like 600 vampire stories in their inbox every day. So I'm glad they look past the, oh, wait, this is a vampire story. I like doing that too. I like taking existing genres and kind of twisting them on their head. As I said, with Black Mamba, I'd taken crime noir, which God knows we have enough crime noir comics. But again, it did something different with that. And so similarly, I've taken a vampire story, but it's about colonialism and it's about set in a different location.
And different vampires. They're not the same vampires. They don't sparkle.
Yeah, they're not sexy teen vampires.
I've blocked those vampires out from my vampire canon. They don't exist.
Exactly.
They're an aberration.
Do you think now that you've had more success that Black Mamba will be maybe come over here? Will we see it republished?
So
I'd like to read it.
There might be a potential for Black Mamba Volume 2 coming out through a publisher next year.
Cool.
Sweet. Awesome.
I will talk more about it when I can.
Yay. you also have another project, the White Noise Collective, that I read about as well. And I know that's also part of this book, too. The Savage Shores came out. It's part of that,
yeah,
right? The White Noise
so
marketing. Yeah.
We're four writers all based out of the UK. And we kind of started coming up at the same time alongside each other. And we liked the work that we were all doing. Mutual admiration club, if you will. And yeah, at some point we just said, you know, why don't we turn this into a studio and you know, send each other's work around and take feedback and take help. And that really made a difference. I mean, since we started the studio, two of us have done image books. Two of us have worked for DC. A bunch of us are now working at various other companies, you know, doing stuff with Lionforge, doing stuff at Valiant. So,
nice.
Yeah, it's worked. And I mean, I guess the proof of what we're doing is in the kind of books that we're putting out. I mean, all of our books have been quite successful at Falk, you know, Deep Roots, Frendo, Fearscape. They've all done fairly well. Yeah,
that's great.
I think these Savage Shores sort of outpaced expectations because it was a relatively low print run for the first issue, right? And then, I just know from being in the store and having tons of people come in and ask for issue number one and having to be like, sorry, we sold them all.
Yeah, we actually bought a lot of
it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that bodes well for the trade.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it does. I think Vault were really happy with it as well. I mean, they expected it. They told me when Adrian was the editor at Vault, was discussing numbers with me, he said 100% we're going to go for a second print run. I was like, well, you're really confident. We'll see. And then 2 days after it released, we were like, oh, well, it's sold out everywhere. And in other good news, I think the second print run also sold out. So Vault are doing a third printing of issue one.
Oh, wow, great. Nice. That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Congratulations.
Yeah, so the book's done really well. You know, fingers crossed. People seem to love it, which is all you can ask for. So I'm enjoying making it, you know?
Yeah definitely. Do you have any other projects that you can talk about? I know you said in January or after January, you'll be having some more.
I've got two creator-owned projects currently greenlit for 2019.
Nice.
And I'll be doing projects that are work for hire at potentially at DC, potentially at other companies, but nothing I can say with any kind of specificity.
Yeah.
So it's that time of year where everything is happening, but I can't.
Right, it's all very secret. We understand that. Like, what's your process when you're writing? Like, do you write like really detailed scripts, or do you what? Just take us through it.
Yeah, like what's an average day look like? An average work day.
Average work day is about 6 hours of writing and about 2 hours of pretending to write. I do about 4 hours during the day and then 4 hours at night. During the day, I go out to a cafe and write because I need to actively ignore people. Otherwise I'll distract myself. And then the second 4 hours I do from like 10:30, 11 at night to about 2 a.m. Yeah. Usually when I get started on a project, I'll do a fairly detailed plot and outline, but I'll only plot to about 2/3 of the way through the story. The last third of the story, I'll leave open because I don't like the idea that I'm working towards an ending. So I'll figure out my ending when I get to it.
Oh wow!
If that makes more sense.
Yeah.
And it allows you sort of freedom to tie up threads that you might not have thought about when you're doing the outline. So yeah, I do a fairly detailed outline, and then when I start scripting, I kind of ignore the outline because I have a general sense of where I'm going with the story, and then I kind of leave myself open to doing things that I hadn't considered when I was doing the outline. For example, at the end of issue two, one of the characters gets imprisoned.
Yeah.
He was not supposed to be imprisoned according to the outline.
Oh, interesting. Oh. Huh.
He was going to continue his hunt.
He comes back and becomes an important piece of the puzzle, which wouldn't have been the case if I had stuck to the outline.
Yeah.
So I do that. I write fairly detailed scripts. I always get people asking, what kind of notes did you give your artist? I'm like, no, I just describe everything. It's all in the script. I don't give my artist extra notes and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I think the artists appreciate that as well. Like, they look at the script, they know exactly what they need to know. I don't tend to over describe things. I don't tend to tell them, no, the sky needs to be this color and then the sun needs to be that color. It needs to be here.
Yeah.
Rather than do that, I'll convey what is logistically important in a panel, and then I'll try to convey the mood or the tone of the story in my description rather than tell them the specifics, because they're very good at what they do. And the more detail I give them in terms of the specifics, it's only going to hold them back.
Right. Yeah, the hunter, going back to him really quick, I thought he was a monster too because he's so pale. And I'm like, is he a vampire?
Nah, it turns out he's just British.
He's just British.
That's what those guys look like sometimes.
Yeah, he's a gnarly, kind of grumpy old British dude. Yeah. So, he's not a monster, but he certainly faced a fair few in his time. You can see that when he's putting a shirt on, he's got all those scars on his back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He's also allergic to the sun.
Yeah. Yeah, and really, really grumpy.
And really, yes, really.
I like writing grumpy characters.
Well, when you're facing monsters all the time, I guess, and that's all you do.
Yeah, there's a grump-inducing activity. Yeah.
I really enjoyed writing that guy. I think I enjoyed it because I don't think a lot of people expected to see him again at the end of issue one. So when issue two started off, and the number of people who wrote into me were like, oh man, I hadn't realized you were going to change the guy who's narrating the story. I'm not going to spoil things for those who haven't read the end of issue one. Kind of becomes impossible for the same guy to continue narrating the story. So people were surprised to see this guy come in and start narrating, and hopefully each issue you'll be a little more surprised.
Yeah. Oh, like other people are going to narrate the story? Oh, now I want to know.
Yeah. That's a good three.
Yeah. I know, definitely. I can't wait.
there's even a bit which is narration but taken from an official military report written from one of the East India Company military commanders back to his... Yeah. So we've done all sorts of things with the book. So it should be interesting to read a story that's been told by so many different people put together, you know?
Yeah, I really like that. Was it hard to transition from like your own creator-owned work to like a DC comic too? Like jumping to like Batman? That was like your first like big two work.
I mean, not at all. Frankly, if you don't already have a Batman story when you start writing comics, at least in your head, then you're doing it wrong.
I know I do.
Yeah. But I'm one of those guys that kind of... I loved comics when I was a kid, and then I was weaned away from them by my parents who said, you have to read serious books, blah, blah, blah. And I got back into comics... when I was fairly older. I was 21, and a friend of mine gave me the first volume of Sandman for my 21st birthday. And before that, in India, when I was a kid, we had very different kinds of comics available. we didn't have a lot of access to the Batman Superman stuff. Mm-hmm. Rather, you know, I used to read Phantom and Mandrake and Flash Gordon and all those guys. Mm-hmm. So my exposure to the Batman and Superman stuff and all of the Marvel characters was after I started reading Sandman. And I moved from there to the sort of Alan Moore, Warren Ellis, Garth mm-hmm. Ennis, Grant mm-hmm. Morrison, all the big influential names of their time.
Right.
So by the time I was done with that, I was already in a place where I was thinking about writing more as a professional rather than as a mm-hmm. As a fan. And I don't mean that in a negative sense. I just mean that I got into writing because I love writing, not mm-hmm. because right. I love a character. And so when the opportunity for Batman came up, you know, a lot of people sort of assume that you're going to be intimidated by the idea of writing. But in my head, you know, I'm a professional. This is what I do. You mm-hmm. give me mm-hmm. a character, I will write a good story with it. And so I've never sort of been intimidated writing any character. But I will say I was kind of surprised to hear, hey, so do you want to do a Batman story? I'm like, whoa, my first gig doing a work for hire character is going to be Batman. Wow.
Yeah, definitely. You're like, not Hawkman?
Yeah, not Red Hood, not a lesser character.
Not even Aquaman. Aquaman's going to be big.
I'm kind of working on the script and, you know, I'm writing down my descriptions and I go, and Batman jumps in through the roof. And I had to pause and go, wait, did I just write Batman jumps into? That's pretty cool.
That is pretty cool. One day I hope to be there.
Yeah. Speaking of superhero characters, I want to know about your personal origin story as a comic book creator. Was there like a particular, life event or something that made you say, like, not only do I want to do this, but I can do this as a viable career? Because it's like any creative pursuit, they're notoriously a difficult way to make a living, like financially uncertain, like career instability. Like, what made you think that this was like a viable path for you?
Right, because you were a chemical engineer first, right?
Oh man, you guys have done your research.
Yeah, a real like hard job.
Yeah.
I used to be a chemical engineer, and I studied to be a chemical engineer for a really long time. I had a master's in material science.
Wow.
When I graduated. I did that at Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. And so when I was working at that job, it involved a lot of traveling. And mm-hmm. I used to travel. I traveled all over the Middle East, Europe, Asia.
Wow.
And when I used to do that, I used to write as a hobby on airplanes and in the hotel rooms, because it can be a lonely thing kind of traveling mm-hmm. by yourself for work.
Yeah.
And so I used to spend a lot of time writing, and I'd always written even as a kid. And some of those things that I wrote, you know, I sent off to magazines and online publications, and a couple of those got published, which, you know, always is very encouraging when you're doing something as an amateur and then you sent it out and professionals come in and tell you, hey, you're actually good at this. And so I had that experience with my prose when I first started off. By the time 2012 came about, I was getting pretty tired of the kind of work that I was having to do. Mm-hmm. Spending there are times where I spent days in the middle of a desert on an oil field, measuring the content of water in oil that's being drilled from the ground every couple of hours. dramatic, I know. But yeah, no, I got really tired of doing that. I did that for 7 years. And in 2012, I quit and I said, you know what? I'm going to take up this thing I've been doing as a hobby, which I've had a fair bit of success in. Mm-hmm. I'm going to take that up and try and do it professionally. And, you know, I was lucky in that the first few things I did seem to take off. Some measure of talent involved as well. I won't be weirdly humble about that, but but there's a lot to be said. There are a lot of talented people out there. There's a lot to be said for endeavoring to be in the right place at the right time. So I've never been one to sort of shirk the work that goes into making sure that your work is seen and read by people as well. So I did my comic again. I self-published when I moved. So I moved to the UK to study creative writing, actually. I moved in 2013 because all of my favorite grumpy, brooding writers came from the UK. Yeah. So, you know, your Alan Moore, your Neil Gaiman, your Grant Morrison, all of them are UK-based writers. So yeah. I said, there must be something in the water there. So I wanted to move to London. I wrote a novel as part of my course. And then by the time that course was done, I'd self-published Black Mamba. And I was getting attention from all the right people for having done that book. So I think the big breakthrough was when I gave Black Mamba to Eric Stevenson when he was at Thought Bubble in the UK. I had the first few pages of Paradiso with me, and I walked up to his table, showing him the book and pitching it to him. When Kieran Gillen walks by and goes, "Eric, you should see Ron's work. Ron, pitch to Eric." And they just walked away. Wow.
Good job, Kieran. It was amazing. So we'll blame it all on
him. Yeah, no, that was a good recommendation. Yeah. And kind of off the back of that, the image book happened.
Yeah.
I kind of knew I'd be okay with writing because I'd been doing it for so long.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it wasn't really a matter of going, oh, yeah, this is... But I knew I'd be okay professionally when, you know, I self-published Black Mamba. It did fairly well on its Kickstarter.
Right.
And then the next thing I got off of that was an image project. At that point, I knew I'd be okay.
And you knew you could always just fall back into the oil fields if it didn't work out. Back to that master's degree.
To be honest, I'm one of those guys who dives in both feet, no backup plans.
Right.
Screw that parachute.
You could always write about the oil fields too.
I mean, a lot of my sort of science and engineering background finds its way into the stories in any case. So,
oh, for sure, definitely. And did you use it in Paradiso at all? I mean, definitely, I could see that.
Like a lot of the stuff about the cloud which turns into the fog. In Paradiso is to do with potential self-repairing and self-structuring nanomaterials.
Yeah.
Which is what I did my master's in.
Oh, wow.
So definitely a lot of stuff from my science background that's poured into that book.
Yeah, that's very helpful. Awesome.
So you've done some work for DC and it sounds like you have some more coming up. Is there a particular like mainstream big two character that you would love to at some point write for?
I mean, frankly, I'd love to write Batman. But
yeah, sure.
I mean, if you're going to aim high, right? So no, but there are characters that I'd love to work with at both companies. You know, I'd love to do a Doctor Strange story because, you know, he gets his powers in the vicinity of where I come from. So I feel like that part of him going to Kamar-Taj and getting all his powers has never been. I mean, the movie does it, but it does it in a very flat way, in my opinion.
Yeah,
there's a lot more to be dug into there, and I can definitely do that. So there are stories I have in my head for characters about companies, but frankly, you know, as a professional, I'll tell a good story no matter what character you send my way. So
you don't want to take a crack at Mandrake the Magician since you had him. I think we need a good Mandrake story.
For the longest time. I wanted to do a Phantom story.
Yeah.
Phantom was my favorite character when I was a kid. And just out of pure nostalgia, I wanted to do a Phantom book.
I love the Phantom. That would be
great. I don't know what's up with that IP and where it is right now. I have a killer story idea for a Phantom arc.
That would be great.
If anyone's listening, dun, dun, dun.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you listen to Dynamite, I guess.
A Dynamite might have it. Yeah. They might have it still. They had it for a while, and I mean, no one has done a good one.
They haven't really put out a Phantom book in a really long time, and I don't know why.
Yeah, well, and they always do one, and then it always has like a terrible artist, and it never sells. So, yeah, definitely you do it and bring one of your amazing artists with you, and everyone will buy it.
Done.
Well, now we've come to the part of our podcast where we have to ask you our stupid podcast question that we ask everybody.
Which is more topical now than ever, perhaps.
It's super topical.
The movie's coming out.
Yeah, yeah. So it's very important that we ask Aquaman, beard or no beard?
Yeah. Beard. Definitely beard.
Definitely nice. Beard, yeah. Especially with a movie. Yeah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Great. Well, also, thank you for your answer. We will put it in our poll.
Streamlined, clean-shaven Aquaman reminds me of Olympic swimmers, which is not a good thing to be reminded of.
True, yeah.
I just think when he has no, he would be able to swim faster. But maybe he has like a power where it doesn't matter. Yeah. I don't
know. He's so good at swimming that it doesn't matter how.
It doesn't matter. I'll just like stream right through.
Yeah, non-hydrodynamic he is. That's part of his power set.
Look, it would be unfair to all the other people swimming if he tried to swim. The beard's there, so it kind of equalizes stuff.
Okay.
Also, difficult to shave underwater.
Yeah.
Like the salt water probably irritates your skin. And, you know.
I think he has like, what, does he have like an octopus help him?
I'm taking notes for my Aquaman arc.
Yeah, awesome.
For sure, cannot use an electric razor.
I would love to see an octopus shave Aquaman in a comic.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think it'd be amazing. Well, Ram, thank you so much for being on the show today. We really appreciate it. And we wish you luck.
Thanks for having me on.
Yes. We wish you luck in the new year. And Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays and all of that.
Yeah, and everybody run out and pick up Paradiso and these Savage Shores for holiday for gifts.
Yes. Yeah, all the gifts. Yeah. All the Rombie gifts. Awesome.
Do it. Make it a Rombie Christmas.
Make it a Rombie, exactly. All right, guys. Thank you so much. And we will talk to you maybe next week. We'll see how the holidays work out.